Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have with us some students from Brookfield Central High School. Would they please stand? We're delighted to welcome you all this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a program, a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, we send them the briefs of the case that they will hear, and the students may engage in activities related to the case. In addition to that, at noon after the second case, the students will meet with a justice of this court and discuss the procedures of the case and decision-making, not the substantive issues involved in the case. And everyone is welcome to join the students at the session at noon. For those in the audience who do not have a copy of the facts of this case and don't have a summary and want one, if you raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary of the case. It's just easier to listen to and understand the case if you have a synopsis of it. While the case synopsis is being handed out, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Justice Rogensack is the justice with whom you will meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Cropps, newly elected to this court for a 10-year term. Seated to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case for today, which is 04AP2592, Robert W. Bartholomew versus Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. Arguing on behalf of Robert Bartholomew is attorney Timothy J. Aiken. Mr. Aiken.
Good morning, members of the court. I'm Tim Aiken. I represent the Bartholomew family and Mr. Bartholomew and the estate of Helen Bartholomew. Let's imagine that the legislature passes a new medical malpractice law meant to alleviate an alleged crisis. And that law states that anybody with a net worth of $5 million or more can no longer bring a case for medical malpractice in our state. That type of law would be unheard of. That type of law has never been contemplated. But under the Moran interpretation, the mirror image of that law is exactly what occurs here. The Moran interpretation prohibits us from representing seniors, homemakers, the people on welfare, the people who are employed less, not employed at all, minimum wage, and to a large extent, children. The courthouse, the right to a remedy, the right to the jury trial, the right to access is barred for people without money and without a financial loss of earning capacity under the Moran interpretation. We just can't bring those cases.
Well, as a practical matter, you can't. But as a legal matter, you can.
Yes, Madam Chief Justice, that's right. And that's why I like to emphasize to my class at Marquette Law that our courts are both courts of law and equity. And the practical effect is more important than the legal effect. The practical effect, and I might add that when the legislature increased the limits to $350,000 and $500,000, it recognized, Mrs. Schultz's primary testimony was, I can't find a lawyer. Mrs. Miller's primary testimony was, I can't find a lawyer.
Well, what's the limit here?
The limit here is $350,000.
Okay.
And the question is it also imposed upon the living claim, which since time immemorial in this state, we quote a case from 1899, it's never been done before. But the practical effect is not only if we do bring the claim. I think the court should be aware. The defense names 2 to 3 experts versus us. That's a right to jury trial. They have 3 or 4 lawyers compared to our one. They travel and take depositions of our experts while we attend by telephone. We don't even take the depositions of defense experts anymore. You can't do it in these type of claims. So that when we talk about the legal principles or the theoretical of how what is right and what is wrong under equal protection or right to access or right to a remedy, the practical effect is disastrous. I see about 10 medical malpractice potentials a week before the Morin case. It jumped to 30. No one wants these cases.
Okay, well, let's get to the law.
Okay.
All right, we've done the equity.
Okay.
In Morin, there were 3 potential interpretations of the 2 statutes involved, right?
According to the Morin majority, there was.
That's right. One is that the medical malpractice, $350,000 with its increases applied to both wrongful death and everything. Medical mal, it covered everything.
Yes.
The second one was that both the wrongful death applied for loss of companionship, right, after death.
Yes.
And the medical mal applied to everything else. You added the two together.
Yes.
The third was that the wrongful death applied only in medical mal.
Retroactively, so to speak, yes.
Well, all right, it applies. The majority adopted the third.
Yes.
Right? The concurrence adopted the second. Right? What are you advocating?
Well, clearly, since we have the Ferdinand case decision, I'm advocating that even if the proper reading, I think, clearly was not, with all due respect to the Morin majority, was not as advocated, and that there should have been 2 caps applied in Morin at that time. But, of course, now this Court has ruled that the living cap is unconstitutionally low, and therefore I would advocate that there is no cap on our living claim.
Okay. That then tells me that what you're applying is either the first that only the Med-Mal applies, or 2, the stacking applies. If only Med-Mal applies here, then you say, well, I'm home free because that statute's unconstitutional.
For this case, that's true.
Okay. If the stacking applies, then what you say is, as to the wrongful death, that's still good, but as to the Med-Mal, that's out from Ferdinand.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So what is your position?
My position is, I guess I'll state what my position was before Morin came down. My position would have been that if the cap is constitutional, which of course we objected to,
right,
but if it's constitutional, there are 2 caps.
Okay.
And I think that's clearly indicated not only in the statutes. I don't think we need to go to statutory history. It's clearly there. But as importantly, the fact that the death caps were raised in order to allow access to the courts, I think further shows that the legislature did not intend a global cap, a one cap. And the fact that since the time our state was founded, these have been two different causes of action. These are two different people. I think there's a statement in the Moran majority that says, for all practical purposes, the survivors of, under the estate and under the malpractice are the same. That's often true, but that is not anywhere near universal in my practice. I've seen, and we cite some of the examples that I've seen in my practice where divorcees or they're about to be in a divorce. I've seen spouses give up their claim. I've seen it willed to other people for a number of reasons. So that, but importantly, under the law, is the estate of Helen Bartholomew is a separate person and is different than the wrongful death claimants. I think that we cited one part of this Brown case and attached it in our appendix since it was such an old case. You can see my book is falling apart, but if a person be wrongfully injured, the payment suffering expenses to him in consequence thereof shall not be lost to his estate by the circumstances of his death. That's exactly what Moran does. Moran says if you die, suddenly your cases become more limited.
Mr. Aiken, if I could, you've argued that there are two caps, and accepting that proposition for the time being and for purpose of this question, do we still not have to deal with 89355 sub 4B that says the total non-economic damages recoverable for bodily injury or death, including any action or proceeding based on contribution or indemnification, may not exceed the limit under paragraph D for each occurrence? So in other words, assuming you have separate claims, you've got a survivorship and a wrongful death claim, and assuming that they're kept separate, do those two claims under this statute, are they still limited by what was then the cap, assuming the cap was valid, under 4D?
No, because it says or death, not and death. And also, I might add, it's probably of not much relevance, but the new statute, the new cap, bumps out that or death.
No, I understand. That's why I'm looking specifically at the old statute, and I understand the burden that's to the survivorship cap. But my question, and it kind of goes to whether, assuming for purpose of the question, if the court were to accept that the occurrence theory is correct, that, is it, would you agree or disagree that Ferdin, Warren perhaps applied the wrong cap? Instead of saying that the global cap is the wrongful death cap, the global cap should have been the survivorship cap.
I'll answer it this way. In my opinion at the time, that we were arguing Bartholomew, Moran had not come down.
Right.
I could understand the defense's position. I insisted that it had to say and death in order to limit both. But I could understand their argument. I think one of the reasons why the Moran argument was never made by anybody was because everyone has recognized these are two separate causes of action. So that's why I think Moran was wrongly decided. And probably because there wasn't a briefing on that subject. But I still think that the word had to be and death in order to have a global cap. Plus, and we didn't brief this thoroughly at the Supreme Court level because we don't have a cap anymore, but at the trial court level, we briefed it thoroughly. The concept of global cap was discussed by the legislature thoroughly, and it was rejected. And the legislative history is clear on that. They tried to get a global cap and did not. So if we're going to look at, should it be an and or an or, but we look at legislative history, in the trial court, we thoroughly briefed this subject, which is why, before Moran came down, our 90th day was July 1st, Moran came down, I think, July 2, the trial court decided that the higher cap applied, but he did rule against us on the idea of two caps. But we have thoroughly argued our position as Attorney Michael End had argued it in Moore, a similar argument. And I think if one looks at legislative history, it's quite clear that they did not intend a global cap, regardless of the use of the word and or.
Mr. Aiken, are you asking us to overrule Moore?
I'm afraid I am.
Don't be afraid. Let's be forceful. Are you saying, in effect, that the concurrence was right? And
yes.
If so, what? That was an argument was made. It may not have been brief, but the argument was made in the concurrence, right?
The argument was made in the concurrence, yes.
Rejected.
Well, it was rejected by the court then, but without proper briefing for the decision that was made. I think it would be a more difficult issue for the court to reverse Morin if Morin had taken the position of a global cap and applied the cap in D to the whole case. I think that would be a tougher case to say, well, a year or two later we're going to reverse it, although as I comment in my reply brief, the court in Acre, a case I handled, reversed the Makos case, a case I handled that was only, I think, 2.5 years old, and stare decisis didn't get in the way there. I think that the Morin decision is, I'm going to go backwards this. I wrote our brief about how I thought Morin was wrong, and my partner here comes to me and says, you know, you haven't given any citation to the concurrence in Morin. I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, you're basically just regurgitating the same thing Morin said. I said, Jim, I forgot to read the concurrence. I just wrote the brief on what I thought the law was. So that by coincidence, I came up with many of the same or all the same arguments that the concurrence had without even being aware of it. I think that's how clear the statutory scheme is. Damages for wrongful death have always been damages for wrongful death. We've never had a per-person wrongful death limit. I've never thought of that, heard of it in 31 years. And survival actions and wrongful death actions have always been separate.
Mr. Aiken, if I could, I mean, here's the problem that I have with at least a portion of the argument. Granted that, as you pointed out in your brief, the separation of survivorship actions from wrongful death actions was not briefed before the court. And granted the a lot of the things, the cases you cite, the Brown, the Kohler case, they weren't before the court. But the concurrence did address at least part of the issue. And as to the issue that the concurrence addressed that was rejected by the court, how do we handle that now, 2 terms later?
Well, one of the principles of stare decisis, one of the additional considerations that we listed, is whether or not the case was wrongly decided. And I can tell the court that defense and plaintiff malpractice lawyers never saw Morin coming and after Morin didn't accept it. The court is, I'm sure, aware that even though Morin was decided 2 days after the time period in my case, I reserved my right to appeal the Morin decision, even though it wasn't a month old. That's how wrong I thought it was. And the idea that, I mean, we have to have respect for stare decisis, but when I read the decision, I just said this is not an appropriate view of what damages for wrongful death are versus survivorship. And I think I would have appealed even if they had found a global cap in Morin that was the other cap, because I thought the legislative history was so clear. But this was so different, and I think I said this to the court before. I don't know if I could be a justice because all the areas of the law you all have to handle. I mean, I don't know how you do it. I'm in this narrow area, and I know it quite well. I teach it at Marquette Law. But so, for example, did the court know that there was a case over 100 years old that said these two types of actions are separate and distinct? And I don't find anything in the legislative history or in the statutes that indicates the legislature wanted to abolish that distinction by virtue of passing these medical malpractice acts.
Mr. Aiken, let me interrupt, if I might, for a minute. You mentioned earlier the new CAPS bill. My understanding is that was published today. It's effective tomorrow. Does that in any way play a role in the decision that we've got to make in this case?
Legally, I don't believe it does. It's not retroactive, so its impact is going to be felt probably 3 to 5 years from now, I would say. We analyzed that thoroughly for our practice as well as this case. I think the only interesting thing is that they didn't eliminate the words or death, and I've searched the legislative history to figure out why, because to me it demonstrates that when they eliminated death that they wanted to eliminate this ambiguity that they meant there to be a global cap, which, again, the legislative history is quite clear. They did not intend a global cap. Because, see, the problem is that we never wanted to make it cheaper for a defendant to kill someone than let them live. And there are countries in the world, our neighbor to the south, Mexico, has that rule. And there are reported cases down there in the papers where people end up getting killed who are only injured in accidents because it's $10,000 for death and it's lifetime support otherwise. So you don't want a rule of law that makes it cheaper to kill than to let someone live, particularly with a profession that has life in its very hands. It doesn't take much to recognize a screw-up and turn the medicine the wrong way.
Counselor, you aren't suggesting that a doctor would kill a patient that he had negligently injured so the damages would be less. I hope you're not suggesting
that. I'm not suggesting that would occur. I'm suggesting in other countries that type of thing does occur. And I'm just suggesting as a public policy, Your Honor, we have never wanted it to be cheaper for a defendant to kill someone than to live. And part of that reasoning is the fact that it provides the wrong incentives and it's not a just result. But what, a doctor killing someone? I seriously doubt, but we know that a nurse in New York killed something like 50 or 60 people. I don't quite understand.
That's criminal conduct, Counselor. Right. That's not what we're here about today. We're here about negligence.
Yes, we're here about negligence, and we're here about negligence by a physician or a hospital or a nurse working in a hospital. And I would hope no one would ever do such a thing, but I'd still say that that's the principle behind the law. It's been the principle behind the law for a long time, that we don't make it cheaper to kill someone than to let them live.
Mr. Aiken, could I ask you a hypothetical question? If in this case Mrs. Bartholomew had lived longer and survived the trial, and you got a verdict at the trial on medical malpractice, did you believe that the old law would have allowed a wrongful death action later by the family?
No.
Why not?
Because I think it's quite clear you have to die to have a wrongful death case. You bring a case like that as a living claim, even though you're predicting death. The law that the case has to be, you have one case, it's consumed by one case, I think applies so that if you later die, at least theoretically, you're supposed to submit those damages as one case. I think the tougher question is
Do you have to join those cases? Do you have to join wrongful death and the living case?
Yes, but the hypothetical was she dies after the trial.
No, but if you have to join them, then you got a problem.
We've never been successful in convincing a trial court to allow us to proceed on a wrongful death claim, even though everyone agrees that the person is going to die. That's the practical answer I can give you. I've never been able to do it, and the statute pretty clear. It says damages for wrongful death. There's not a death yet. So you go under a different way. You go loss of enjoyment of life, loss of earnings, things like that, to the person who's going to pass away. I have this very situation coming up in West Bend. Mr. Gagliardi has a situation coming up in Janesville. What we don't know under Moran is what happens if you get to trial, you get your verdict, and the person dies during trial or right after trial before the judgment is rendered. Is Moran now an umbrella that comes over it? Also, it provides incentives for the defense to stretch the case out, hoping the person will die. I actually filed a brief in that regard, asking the trial court in West Bend for an earlier trial because I didn't want my client to die because of the impact of Moran on the case or potential impact. So direct answer to the question, we handle it as a loss of enjoyment of life case rather than a death case.
Counselor, do you have to bring a wrongful death claim in a medical malpractice case if you started out, whether the person's dead or alive, and you simply claim for medical negligence?
This was another interesting thing because in my case in West Bend, I suggested that maybe we don't want to prove that the death is going to be associated with malpractice, although that's tricky to do. The question is, will the defense then put it in as a defense?
Counselor, it says it's a claim in the statute. Okay. And my question to you is simple. Do you have to bring a claim for wrongful death when there is alleged medical malpractice? Or can you simply bring a straight-up medical malpractice case? Can the plaintiff make that choice?
That's not ever been decided. I would attempt to make
the claim. I have a claim for breach of contract and negligence. I can pick which one I want to bring unless the economic loss doctrine pops in, and then sometimes you can't. But
that isn't the same thing. The question here is, can I waive my wrongful death claim in order to stop Moran's import? And then the response is, can the defense then attempt to prove the death was caused by malpractice, if there was malpractice, and therefore bring Moran in on its own? There is no law on the subject because before Moran, that was never a topic. It was never necessary.
Well, the statute talks about a claim. It doesn't just talk about, it's not just a damages statute. It's a claim statute. And so, my question is, if you don't like the cap on it and there's no cap on the other damages, why couldn't you just bring one claim?
So what I guess your suggestion is that I represent the people who have the living claim, and then some other lawyer gets the death claim and makes a decision to waive it?
My question is simple. It's just, could you do it or not? It doesn't have anything on it.
My answer to the question is, as the lawyer for the estate, yes, I could. As the lawyer for the wrongful death claimant, the answer is no, I couldn't. I have a duty to represent those claimants. And they are sometimes different.
Might have a conflict of interest if you represented both when one has no cap and the other one does.
Oh, absolutely I would have a conflict, yes. Under Moran, I have a clear conflict. And I briefed that subject in our brief that's the problem. And certainly in this case, since we never saw the third leg, the Moran leg coming, we put in both cases. And the claimants were the same. So in that case, I could have probably gotten a waiver. But when the claimants are different, I couldn't possibly get a waiver because what would be the justification? That the people who have the living claim want the money and you get none? So I'd have to have two lawyers. And what lawyer's going to waive it?
Mr. Akin, the facts of this case are really materially different from the Moran case. Shea Moran was the victim of a misdiagnosis, but she didn't survive much more than 24 hours, and she was unconscious most of that time. And yet the jury awarded $500,000, if memory serves me correctly, for that 24-hour period. Now, here we have 5 years. I don't have any problem at all of going under the basic malpractice damage, which right now there is no cap. It's a completely different situation. And what I think was troublesome to me as the author of the opinion that you're attacking is that you were trying to stack, or not you, but the attorneys were trying to stack one award on another, $500,000 a day, in effect.
I'm not sure what the question is, but in Moran, the trial judge remitted the award from whatever the jury gave to what that trial judge thought was a more reasonable sum. For 100 and some years, that's always been the law in the state. We let the trial judges remit or editor in order to solve what may have been jury outrage, may have been jury prejudice.
Let me put the question this way. Can Moran be interpreted to turn on the fact that survivorship there was less than 24 hours? Can you interpret Moran to say, hey, if you only live 24 hours, it's a wrongful death, and that's it?
I think if the court wanted to say that the envelope of a survivor claim and a death claim can be consumed if it isn't completed within a certain time frame, that certainly would be within the jurisprudential power of the court. That hasn't ever occurred before, though.
Where does it stop? What about 2 days?
That's my point. I don't know where it would stop because it's never been done. And I think
statute doesn't say anything about how long.
It does not. And I can understand if someone's completely unconscious from the time of accident to the time of death, that a court may want to say being unconscious is the same as being dead if you have no living consciousness.
There may be medical differences about whether
right.
you're unconscious, you feel pain, et cetera.
That would be under some sort of flow doctrine that the court would have to invent that I'm not aware of. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think that the court would be better off going back to the way the law always was, that there's two claims, they're separate and distinct. If the jury awarded too much money in Morin, which apparently the trial court thought they did, it should be reduced by the trial court. We now have a new cap that will also cap it to avoid apparently what one might consider a runaway. But in the Morin trial court, the sum would have come under the new cap, but yet the trial court thought it was much too high, and the trial court did what trial courts are supposed to do, and they think awards are too high. And it happens.
Aiken, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Means, attorney Stephen P. Means, representing the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would, the rest of the justice, I'd like to introduce Rasheen Bell, an attorney with my firm who's been assisting me on this case. Before I start, let me just say that much of what Mr. Aiken has argued today and in his brief, I simply can't respond to. The arguments are inappropriate for the Supreme Court. What happens in his personal experience, what he says everybody knew or everybody understood about the law, there's no basis for that in the record, and certainly that's not the type of argument that should be made before this court. Those are legislative arguments. Whether or not somebody can find a lawyer for a malpractice claim, that's a legislative argument. Certainly my personal experience is much different than Mr. Aiken's. I get phone calls regularly about health care providers who are having small claims asserted against them. The idea that we always have to face multiple experts, we don't get to travel when they travel, those are not arguments for this court.
Okay, let's get to the law.
The law in this case, I think, starts with the Ferdin case. The argument has been made that somehow Ferdin changes the analysis and somehow Ferdin undermines the Morin decision and makes an inconsistency that can't be allowed to stand. I suggest to the court that that's simply not true. It was approximately a year ago today that I was before this court in the Ferdin case, and I argued that if you overrule the cap in Ferdin, you're going to have to overrule other damage caps. You're going to have to overrule Morin because Morin is direct precedent. And if you uphold that case, you can't strike down the damage cap in Ferdin. And the court disagreed with that. At paragraph 16 of the Ferdin decision, it said, this court has not held that statutory limitations on damages are per se unconstitutional. Indeed, this court has recently upheld the cap on non-economic damages for wrongful death medical malpractice actions.
Well, here's the problem with that argument.
Excuse me?
Here's the problem. And I think those words may have come from an opinion I wrote in Ferdin. And then those words are terrific. So here's the issue. If you agree that there's a survivorship action and a wrongful death action, that is for damages after death, the survivorship damages are not wrongful death damages, historically. The wrongful death damages are historically statutory, with statutory limits. When I went to law school, it was $5,000 if you got hit by, if there was a tort action. And the inappropriate humor was, if you had an auto accident, it was better to kill everybody because $5,000 covered it. Now, if you apply Morin where there is a 5-year survivorship and you limit that to the wrongful death limit, then you have cut out, you have totally eliminated the survivorship damages. You get zero. And under Ferdin, giving zero for a well-recognized medical malpractice injury is unconstitutional. So how do you fit all that together?
Well, Your Honor, you don't eliminate the estate's claim that survives. That claim is brought within a global cap. That's the same thing that happens in a non-medical malpractice wrongful death case. You have a number of different claimants, each with damage claims, and they're brought together under a single cap.
Well, what about, you know, take an auto accident? And yet, suppose she had been injured in a negligent auto accident. Would there be a cap on her survival damages, non-economic survival damages?
It's my understanding that in that case there would not be.
Would not be a cap. Is there a cap on her wrongful death damages? There is.
On the relatives of the deceased.
Yeah, there is.
That's correct.
Right. So why don't the same rules apply here?
Well, the same rules, and I'm not sure if I understand the question. In this case, let me say, first of all, that I think that the Moran majority did interpret the statutes correctly, and I think that they interpreted them not only consistently with the statutes, but very consistently with the Zipinski decision that Justice Crooks authored a few years earlier. And what it comes down to is the legislature looking at what happens in certain types of wrongful death cases and weighing not only the interests of the plaintiffs who want to sue, but the interests of society and the interests of defendants. And they've come to a judgment as to how to balance those things.
Well, Mr. Means, let's talk about that judgment, because here's the concern that I have. Let's assume, for purposes of the question, that the legislature did do that, that they said that there's an occurrence cap here, all right? When I look at 89355 sub 4B, it says may not exceed the limit under paragraph D for each occurrence. Yeah. Paragraph D is the survivorship cap.
That's correct.
Moran applied the wrongful death cap. I do not see the language within the legislative structure that gets you to sub F. So if assuming that you can have an occurrence approach and assuming that the legislature intended a cap, I'm having problems seeing how the cap was correctly decided in Moran when it applied a wrongful death cap, which under the language of the wrongful death cap says is limited to society and companionship, and yet the other cap deals with other issues, the survivorship actions, the pain and suffering, all of the things that are not covered in wrongful death. So it looks like the circles went the wrong way. So even assuming, even if we were to accept your argument, didn't the wrong cap get applied in Moran? And if we apply the correct cap, doesn't Ferdin deal with the survivorship cap?
Your Honor, the correct cap was applied in Moran, and it was implied in the correct manner. With respect to your question, the statute, subsection 4B, which refers to bodily injury or death, that language is in the statute before subsection F was created. And subsection F, as the Court knows, was enacted in response to the Jelinek decision. And Jelinek came down when there was no cap on malpractice damages. In that decision, this Court said to the legislature, if you want us to go outside of Chapter 655 to limit damages, you need to tell us. And the legislature responded by enacting subsection F. And subsection F says, notwithstanding the limits on non-economic damages, for damages for wrongful death are subject to 895.04. Now, as a little bit of a...
And let's deal with that language. There's nothing in sub 4F that talks about survivorship.
I will get to that.
All right.
But before doing that, I want to take a little bit of sidelight, and that's to touch on the new legislation. In that legislation, they removed the terms or death. That's something that should have been done when they created subsection F after the Jelinek decision. And those words or death is what created some of the ambiguity that I think has caused criticism of the Moran decision. That ambiguity is gone. Again, the words or death should have been taken out after Jelinek. Now, with respect to your decision, the Moran decision is completely consistent with the Zipinski decision that came down a few years earlier. In that case, the issue is whether or not an adult child would have a claim for wrongful death. And what the court did was they understood that if this is a medical malpractice claim, we have to start with Chapter 655. And Chapter 655 doesn't allow adult children to recover. It only allows minor children. And so what the Sapinski court did was it went from Chapter 655 to the wrongful death statute. Excuse me while I bring this into focus. The Sapinski decision applied the dollar figures from 895.044, but it did not limit itself to the claimants that were allowed to recover or the types of claims in that statute. It took the dollar figure. That's exactly what the Morin case did. And those two things are very consistent with the chapters of with the purposes of Chapter 655, which is if this is a medical malpractice case, death or not, your claim has to find support within the terms of this statute. And so, you know, to suggest that you have to take the classification of claimants in here and the types of claims, that not only requires you to overrule the Morin decision, I think it would require you to overrule the Sapinski decision. With respect to the historical classification of wrongful death and survivorship damages, let me say a number of things. One is, certainly had the legislature wanted to combine those two things, they would have the authority to do that. I don't think anybody disputes that the legislature has authority to combine one or two different types of causes of action under a single cap. The question is, did they intend to do it? Now, the term wrongful death, that can mean a number of things. A wrongful death can be an event. And from that wrongful death, you can have a survivorship claim and you can have a wrongful death claim. So to suggest that there's never any circumstances when wrongful death can mean something different than what Mr. Aiton says, it's not true. In fact, you know, if you open the yellow pages to the listings of plaintiff lawyers or go to Mr. Aiken's website, you'll see something that says wrongful death. Are they only wanting to get survivorship claims? I don't think so.
Let me ask this, because this is the problem. And I'm probably going to use the wrong words of art, so please excuse me if I do. But doesn't a statute in derogation of common law have to clearly set forth that it is breaking from the common law? And does this statute, in fact, do that? When it refers to 4D and doesn't take you directly to 4F, and it, in effect, has an impact on survivorship claims, which it does exist in the common law, as opposed to wrongful death, which is a creature of statute. I don't see how this statute clearly indicates that the legislature intended to change the common law here.
Well, I will say that I do think the legislature could have been more clear in what they were intending to do. Obviously, if they had been more clear on one side or the other, we may not be here. But I do think in this instance, it's very clear that when there's medical malpractice, they meant to bring all claims for non-economic damages under a single cap.
Well, here's my problem with this. Under 893.55.4F, which is the statute that Morin says governs, right?
Yes.
And which you agree should govern where there is death as a result of medical malpractice.
I believe that's what the legislature intended.
Right. It says damages recoverable for wrongful death are subject to 895.04(4), right? That's what we see on the screen.
Yes.
When I read 895.044, says that you're recovering only for loss of society and companionship.
And right? Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. So if the wrongful death is subject to the limits under 895.044, it seems to me we're only talking about loss of society and companionship. How do you then get survival actions and everything else in?
Well, I think if you look at this at subsection F, you see two things.
Right.
It refers to wrongful death.
Right.
It also refers to damages recoverable against health care providers.
Absolutely.
In this situation, I think that the wrongful death that it refers to there is referring to an event rather than a legal classification of a type of damage or a claimant.
And you can also argue that limits means 350 and 500, and it doesn't adopt anything else. But ordinarily, it says here, under 895.044 in the first sentence, judgment for damages for pecuniary injury from wrongful death, uses the exact same phrase, may be awarded. Additional damages, and it must mean additional for pecuniary injury from wrongful death, is limited to loss of society. So if you put 893.554F and 895.044 together, and you say 895.044 is the only thing that applies in wrongful death, you wind up with giving damages only for loss of society and companionship.
Your Honor, I think that comes back to
you. Don't agree with that, right? You don't read it that way.
No, I don't.
Everything comes under the 350-500, the way you read it.
Your Honor, that's the Sabinsky decision. That's the Morin decision. I believe that's the legislative intent.
Well, it wasn't, and I'm sorry, I didn't reread Sabinsky before I came in. That was governing loss of society and companionship, wasn't it?
Well, but it was also governing who are the claimants entitled to bring these claims.
Under loss of society and companionship, under 895.044, so it was a wrongful death from medical malpractice limited to the particular claimants for loss of society. That case did not cover survivorship.
That's correct, Your Honor. But what it did do is it covered a claim that's ordinarily allowed under wrongful death that isn't allowed in medical malpractice, and rather than going along with the statutory language in the wrongful death cap, which refers to children, not minor children, it focused on the dollar limits and set aside the classification of claimants and the type of claims. That's exactly what Morin did.
Counsel,
Morin?
I understand.
Counsel, Morin, of course, involved a fact different than the fact we have in this case. The fact in Morin was that the survivorship lasted one day, and here we have 5 years. In your opinion, can you distinguish Morin legally from this case based on the length of time that the plaintiff survived?
One thing Mr. Aiken and I agree on, I believe, is that I do not think that this Court can rule in favor of the plaintiff unless they overrule Morin. There's nothing on the face of the statute that suggests there's a difference in the amount of time that somebody survives. I have not seen anything in the legislative history that suggests that the time someone survives is a relevant consideration. Let me touch briefly on a few more issues. One, I think the fact that we have new legislation on damage cap speaks very strongly to whether or not the legislature believes that Morin correctly interpreted its intent. Obviously, the legislature closely watches the law in this area. It watches what this Court does. And if it sees something it doesn't like, it acts quickly. That's what it did in response to the Ferdinand decision. Nothing in that legislation and nothing after the Morin case suggests any intent to depart from Morin.
I'm not sure I understand or agree with what you just stated, because as I understand what the legislature just did, they took out the words "or death." And by taking out the words "or death," and I don't know that we need to reach that in this decision, but it would seem to indicate that the legislature wanted to separate survivorship actions from wrongful death actions, and the way they cleared up the ambiguity was saying you could have separate caps dealing with the separate actions. That would seem to defeat your argument.
I disagree with that. They took out the words "or death" because that created an ambiguity. The statute where it talked about "or death" then referred the person down to subsection D, which deals with bodily injury and not death. Those are the words that they should have taken out after the Jelinek case when they created subsection F. As the statute reads now, before AB 1073, you come to subsection B, and it says for bodily injury or death, go down to subsection D. And that creates an ambiguity because you go down to subsection F, and it says, notwithstanding anything else, this is what you do when there's a death. And so when they took out the words or death, that removed an ambiguity that was left after Jelinek and after the statute was created, which referred matters from subsection F to the wrongful death cap.
Mrs. Bartholomew suffered a bodily injury, though, didn't she?
That's correct.
It just seems to me unreasonable to say that the cap under 4, is it 4D or under whatever it is, the earlier one, would not apply when the person has lived so long. And I mean, you can document the suffering. I mean, it just seems unreasonable not to be able to take that into account.
And I understand that. My response is, I think that is a legislative issue. The statute as it reads now does not distinguish in how long people live before they die. If someone dies, it's treated one way. If someone doesn't die, it's treated another way.
Counselor, can a plaintiff choose to bring an action for medical malpractice and not bring anything for wrongful death and then be subject to the new cap of $750,000 and not the cap contained in the wrongful death statute?
Your Honor, I anticipated that question listening to Mr. Aiken's argument, and I formulated my answer, and it's I don't know. I wish I had a better answer, but I simply don't know. I suspect that plaintiff's lawyers may try that, and I suspect that defense lawyers would have arguments against it, and I just don't know.
Let's talk about a claim in the statute. It is not just a damages statute, and we have some of those. So you could say, well, if you have this claim and your damages fall in this category, you get X, and if they fall over here, you get Y. This is a separate claim, and I guess I wonder why, if you can choose between other kind of claims that you bring, and it's dealer's choice if you're the plaintiff, why you can't choose just not to bring that particular action. I understand Mr. Aiken's concern about leaving folks out, but you don't know. That's your answer.
I don't know. However, okay. It's certainly possible that next April Mr. Aiken and I will be here talking about that.
Well, it's an easier one if everybody is the same and has all the parties are the same. So the estate has the husband and or children as minor children as beneficiaries, and the husband and minor children are of the wrongful death, and it's all one and the same. Then you can choose the higher. You might be able to choose the higher limit and say, okay, let's go for it, which, of course, you would object to, saying that's not what the statute allows. I mean, that would be your position. You don't know who's going to win, but that would be the position of the other side.
Well, that would be the position of the other side, certainly.
Okay.
Yes.
Could you explain, in terms of the facts, Mrs. Bartholomew was in a nursing home for 5 years. How were those expenses paid?
There was, I believe, an award for economic damages as well in that case. Whether those
later on, or, I mean, what happened during the 5 years?
I believe that those were within the damage claim that was at issue at trial, and I do believe there was an award for economic damages.
And that's not an issue here.
That's not in dispute here. It does bring up a point which I think is also relevant to Justice Rogensack's issue in her comments about, you know, do doctors try to kill people? Are they going to, be incentivized? And let me point out that I think that's a red herring in many respects, one of which is, you know, if somebody dies, the non-economic damages may be limited, but what about the economic damages? There's no guarantee that the total damages are going to be less if there's a death. Also, under the scheme that we've set up, it's not even the doctor who's going to feel the money coming out of his pocket or the hospital, because they don't have liability if they purchase insurance. Insurance companies aren't in the operating room or in the emergency room to take those steps. Certainly the patient compensation fund, which is created to compensate patients, has no interest in doing that. And so that's a red herring. Apart from that, you have professional ethics for doctors. They have their reputations to worry about. They have hospital privileging issues to worry about. The suggestion that death is incentivized is, in all due respect, a silly argument.
It may be, but the public policy underlying this is not. Public policy is that if you kill somebody outright, your damages would be limited to, let's just say, $350,000 here. If somebody lives for 5 years and suffers, we'll put them in a nursing home, they're in pain every single day, all of the expenses of the nursing home have been paid, there's no question now. The question is, and then that person dies as a result of a medical malpractice. Question here is, as a matter of public policy, which we assume the legislature wants good public policy, do you say that that person is awarded this, or the survivors are awarded $350,000, and that the individual gets nothing for the 5 years of pain and suffering? Isn't that the issue?
That is the holding of the Morin decision.
Right.
And I believe...
So they get zero for that if the wrongful death claim for loss of society and companionship is $350,000.
That's correct.
Gets zero for 5 years of suffering.
And let me put that
is
in
that
context.
Right?
That's correct.
And what did the jury give for the pain and suffering?
I believe that for Mrs. Bartholomew it was $500,000.
Okay. And for the loss of society and companionship?
I believe for Mr. Bartholomew it was $350 before death and $350 after death.
Okay. The $350 before death would have come under medical mal, right? Might have, if it wasn't.
Well, I think all of those categories of damages were part of a medical malpractice action.
Oh. The max that they got for loss of society before death and for her pain and suffering before death was $350.
That's correct.
So in effect, $500,000 became zero.
No, that's not correct.
How was it divided?
That was a judgment that was made by Mr. Aiken and his client. The judgment read that the $350,000 was payable to Mr. Bartholomew as executor and as an individual.
So they, if you had two different entities, there would have to be a division.
That's correct.
And the $500,000 would be therefore reduced.
The $500,000 would be therefore reduced. That's correct.
Below $350,000.
It would be $350,000 or below, correct. Let me also point out that that happens every time there's a damage cap. If Mrs. Bartholomew had been injured by a volunteer fire company, her total damages would be $25,000, including economics and non-economics. If it had been for a highway defect, $50,000. And so that's something that happens every time you have a limitation. And I suggest to the court that if you focus on one particular plaintiff, it's easy to say it's not fair to that plaintiff, but the legislature doesn't have that luxury. The legislature not only has to think about people out there who may be injured, people who may want to suffer, who recover damages, they have to think about the effects on society, they have to think about the risk of jury passion, they have many things that they have to concentrate on. Going back to your question with respect to Mrs. Bartholomew's damages, this court has noted in the past that when someone dies before they get paid their pain and suffering damages, there's really nothing to compensate because the estate of that person, the assets of that person have not been depleted. And so if there's a $500,000 award for pain and suffering for someone who's dead, that doesn't do them any good because they can't be compensated.
This means you do not dispute that survivorship actions are separate from wrongful death, correct?
I agree that under the case law, if you say survivorship action, it means one thing, and if you say a wrongful death action or a wrongful death claimant, that means something different. That's correct.
And if they mean something different, assuming this court were to say that the decision in Morin with respect to wrongful death stands, as we did in Furden, don't you have a separate issue in the fact that now if you have a separate claim for survivorship, This court in Furden said that the cap on survivorship actions was unconstitutional. So if there's a separate cap, if we're talking about two separate claims here, doesn't the survivorship issue that exists in this case trump the wrongful death cap that you argue should be applied by virtue of the nature of the decision in Furden?
Let me clarify my prior answer. Wrongful death damages are different than survivorship damages. I go back to my comment earlier that wrongful death can also refer to an event. I'd also like to point out that in many respects, these two claims, the survivorship claims and the wrongful death claims, are combined by the statute apart from this issue. For example, the estate, which also holds a survivorship claim, has authority to bring the wrongful death claim on behalf of the relatives. Those relatives who own their claim for loss of society and companionship, they have authority to settle claims which include a release or settlement of the estate's claims.
Maybe I misunderstood your argument. I thought you argued that the effect of the Morin decision was to set the dollar amount, but that you had two separate claims, two separate causes of actions. So my question, once again, is, given the nature of the Furden decision dealing with survivorship caps and the fact that there is no longer, at least currently until tomorrow, a survivorship cap in Wisconsin, doesn't that impact the survivorship portion of the claim in this case?
And if I understand your question correctly, by survivorship claim in Furden, you're referring to the fact that nobody died. Because nobody died in Furden.
That's right. Nobody died in Furden. So the cap on the 4D was ruled unconstitutional in Furden?
Yes.
All right. So the cap in 4D in this case is, assuming this is in the pipeline, unless you disagree, would similarly be unconstitutional. So if you have a survivorship action here in 4D and then you have 4F over here, and the effect of Morin was that the dollar amounts are covered by 4F, but it doesn't dispose of the claim. Doesn't Furden now affect the claim in this case?
And if I understand your question, and I apologize, I'm not sure if I do, you don't get to 4D in this case. Because there's a death, you go to 4F and only 4F. Now, in the distinction...
That goes to the damage amount. I'm just talking about the claim.
Well, let me see if I can... restate Justice Butler's position. In wrongful death actions in medical malpractice, you say that wrongful death relates to an occurrence under medical malpractice, and that all claims for wrongful death in medical malpractice are made up of two parts. One, survivorship claims, and two, wrongful death as used in, I'm sorry you don't have it here, F, that is, loss of society and companionship. And you can do that because medical malpractice, wrongful death, does not mean wrongful death as we talk about it under the wrongful death statute. Isn't that what you're saying?
I don't...
Well, Maureen says that wrongful death under medical mal covers the survivorship claim and loss of society and companionship. You agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Justice Butler is saying that when you define wrongful death in medical malpractice that way, to include both survivorship and wrongful and loss of society and companionship, and you therefore limit the survivorship damages, which are traditionally not wrongful death, right? That what you're doing is that you then fall under Furden, which says you can't limit survivorship damages. Because that's unconstitutional. And what you've done here is you've worked around Furden. So instead of saying the $500,000 limit in Furden
applies. You're saying, no, the $350,000 limit under wrongful death applies. And Justice Butler is asking you, how do you get around Ferdin that way? Because you put survivorship, which is an ordinary living kind of claim, into a cap. And we declared in Ferdin the cap is unlawful. I think that's his question. Is that right?
That's okay. Correct.
That's the question. Got it?
More words than I would have used, but yes.
Well, I think so. Perhaps my answer will tell whether I understood the question or not. In the first place, this Court rejected the idea that Ferdin and Morin rise or fall together. And it was this Court's Ferdin decision which said, Ferdin is a different issue. We're not taking up Morin. That's a different statute, different issues. We're not dealing with that.
That's right. Now the case has come to us involving wrongful death and Morin.
And again, it comes back to what I believe is the legislative intent. And I think it's very clear that the legislative intent is if you have a medical malpractice claim that results in death, but there's a single limit that covers not only all wrongful death claimants, but all survivor claimants.
Okay.
Now, could the legislature have used more precise words? I think they could have. Again, I think we wouldn't be here if they had chosen more precise words, either one way or the other. But the analysis in Morin is very consistent with the legislative purpose. It's very consistent with the statutes. It's very consistent with the Sapinski decision. Now, did I answer the question?
Consistent with Ferdin?
It's consistent with Ferdin because this Court said there's different issues that are involved when there's a death.
Got it.
What is pecuniary injury in 895.044?
Yes. I assume that that would be any type of out-of-pocket expenditures. For example, if it were a family member, if they had to pay burial expenses, if they had to pay other things of that nature. I do think, however, that your question on pecuniary injury raises another point that we haven't heard about, and that is that in a medical malpractice context, yes, you have more claims brought under a global cap. But that's only part of the story. And the part of the story that we don't hear is that in the medical malpractice context, you also have the Wisconsin Patient Compensation Fund that stands behind the defendants and compensates all economic damages. And that's why we're here. If Mr. Bartholomew and the estate of his wife had been required to go against an individual doctor who had no insurance or very limited insurance, we wouldn't be here. But there are trade-offs, and one of the trade-offs is all of the economics are covered. And I think that's a significant factor in this case.
Does economic damages mean pecuniary injury? Are they the same?
I don't know.
They might be.
My understanding of pecuniary injury and economic damages, that means the same thing to me. Whether there's something in the statutes that puts a twist, I don't know.
But, okay.
In general, I think that means being the same.
Okay.
Well, the question to me, and someone can convince me I'm wrong, 895.044 limits non-economic damages for wrongful death, but does not limit economic damages for wrongful death.
I think that's correct.
Are there some non-economic damages that are not covered by subsection 4?
Not in the medical malpractice context, and in the ordinary wrongful death context, there might be some, but they're not compensable damages.
But that's the non-economic damages in medical malpractice are greater in number or types than in wrongful death. Wrongful death, non-economic damages or non-pecuniary damages, just loss of society and companionship. But in the other I don't intend you to make a concession. In
in standard wrongful death, auto accident, loss of society and companionship is what we're talking about. In medical malpractice, non-economic damages are more than loss of society and companionship. There's a list, a long list of them.
I believe that's correct, yes.
We have to change the disc, but you're out of time. Unless, Justice Brasser, do you want to continue? Okay.
I'm going to change it just higher.
Okay. That, is that what it is? All right. Yeah. I'm now advised you don't have to change the disc, right? Okay. We can continue. Right. On the other hand, be prepared, because in about a minute, a loud alarm will go off and lights will be flashing in this room if it's working, and it's the monthly fire alarm. So just stay seated. We will stop discussion at the time, and don't get... You were still at the microphone despite the red light, and I think Justice Prosser wanted to talk to you. No? Does anyone want to talk to Mr. Means? This is nothing personal. All right, Mr. Means, thank you.
Thank you.
You're done. Mr. Aiken.
At least we didn't get a fire hose shot at us for going over. I'd like to make a few other distinguishing comments between Moore and our case. But first, our damages that were eliminated were $850,000, five for pain and suffering, and $350,000 for pre-death loss of companionship. But Mr. Bartholomew, the record reflects, visited his wife every single day of every single year while his wife remained in that nursing home. Another difference between us and Morin is that the Morin plaintiffs did not challenge the living cap that was challenged in Ferdin. They challenged the wrongful death cap. Wrongful death has been a creature of statutes in this state since its inception. That's why the damages could be as low as $5,000, as the Chief Justice referred to when I began practicing law, and now they're at $350,000, $500,000, slowly increased through time. But the legislature has control over wrongful death, which before Moran, they did not have that degree of control over survivorship claims. We challenged the living cap. Here, we did not challenge the wrongful death cap, as they challenged in Moore. So not only did we have a much more substantial conscious pain and suffering claim, but we had we from the very start, never challenged a wrongful death claim, or cap, as was done in Moore.
Mr. Aiken, do you think that if Moore were to be overruled, that Sapinski would have to be overruled as well?
Absolutely not.
Why?
Because Sapinski deals with the legislature's right to describe who the plaintiffs are going to be for loss and companionship in a wrongful death action. And they describe one type of person in a regular case, and they describe another type of person in a medical malpractice case. But my goodness, 30 years ago or 31 years ago when I started practicing, the list was much smaller than it is now. Sapinski was based on, there's a different list for Med-Mal than there is for regular tort cases, but the court has long ago said we're going to recognize that Med-Mal is a different field and the legislature has room to move within Med-Mal and what Med-Mal wrongful death differently than they move in regular wrongful death. So the Sapinski decision really followed Strakowski and all the other cases that challenged the difference between the way medical malpractice victims were treated and regular tort victims. Our challenge and the Ferdin challenge was different in that Ferdin said the challenge was that the people within the medical malpractice field, including death claims, were being treated discriminatingly without equal protection, right to remedy and access. So it's important to remember that wrongful death has always been a creature of statute, and under the common law, there was no wrongful death claim until the legislature created it. I also believe that if the legislature had intended to do what my learned friend from the defense says, they have an obligation to make it clear because they are going against the common law. And if statutes pass in derivation of the common law, it has to be clear. I think by the very fact that counsel has conceded the ambiguity that the legislature could have done it better, the fact that the legislature has now struck the words of death, I think it makes it clear. And even in the Moore case, there was great debate of what the word notwithstanding meant. that the legislature, if they wanted to have the wrongful death cap applied backwards to survivor claims, would have been obligated to do it in a clear and concise fashion, which they didn't. Also, I agree with the concept that what F refers to is the wrongful death statute, and that refers to loss of companionship. So that there is nothing in the wrongful death statute that talks about living pain and suffering claims or living loss-citing companionship claims. So the fact that the statute refers to a wrongful death statute that is limited to talking about the damages that are allowed for loss-citing companionship limits the statute in and of itself. So, and I recognize this was raised in the concurrence, but I think that it's important that if the legislature wanted to bring the pain and suffering claim of a plaintiff, 5 years suffering, into the wrongful death action, that they should have used the words that would imply, at least, that we're talking about living claims, survival claims, or we're at least talking about pain and suffering claims. And there's nothing in either statute that refers to pain and suffering claims. So I think that in this case, FERDA decides whether or not there can be a cap on living claims. Moore doesn't have to be totally overruled because it upheld the wrongful death cap for wrongful death. And we don't challenge the upholding of the wrongful death cap for wrongful death. We challenge the application of that cap backwards into the survival claim. And now, especially since FERDA doesn't allow such a cap, we say that we should be uncapped and collect our total non-economic pre-death damages of $850,000.
Tell me exactly what a survival claim is in your view.
The best way I can explain a survival claim is let's take Mrs. Bartholomew's case before she died, and then let's assume that she got cancer and died. So there is no relationship between the injury and the death. Her survival claim is her suffering, her husband's suffering under the terms loss-citing companionship, and the rest of her economic losses up to the date that she died. And that's before we had wrongful death statutes, that's all there was. When the claimant died either because of the tort or for an independent reason, the claim stopped upon date of death. And that's why there's been a distinguishing feature ever since the Brown case back in 1899 that said there are these claims, and then once one dies, there's a new claim if the death is related to the initial tort. Have I answered it? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Thank you to both Mr. Aiken and Mr. Means for their argument in this case, raising again an interpretation of the medical malpractice statutes. We've heard several of them. They're always very interesting and always very difficult. That concludes our hearing on 048P2592, Bartholomew v. Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. We're going to take a few minutes recess so that these Brookfield Central High School students